Resilience Audio presents the unabridged recording of Summit Lake by Charlie Donley, performed by Shannon McManus. And if all your dreams come true, do your memories still end up haunting you? Is there such a thing as really breaking through to another day and a brighter shade of blue? Christine Kane, She Don't Like Roses. Part 1. The Morning Falls. Chapter 1. Becca Eckersley, Summit Lake, February 17, 2012, the night of her death. The winter night sucked the sky black by the time she left the cafe. She walked the dark streets of Summit Lake and pulled her scarf tight against the cold. It felt good to finally tell someone. It made it real. Spilling her secret relieved the pressure from a long-held burden, and Becca Eckersley relaxed a bit. She finally believed it would all work out. When she reached the lake, the dock creaked under her feet until she stepped onto the wraparound deck of her parents' stilt house. Carefree and liberated after her time at Millie's coffee house, Becca never felt his presence. Didn't notice him in the shadows, hidden under the cover of darkness. She keyed the side door to the mudroom and locked it behind her, then undraped her scarf and slipped out of her heavy coat. She set the alarm and headed to the bathroom, where she climbed under the hot flow of water and let the stress drain from her body. It was a test run, her coffeehouse confession. Practice. She'd kept too many secrets over the last year, this being the biggest and most foolish of them all. The others could be blamed on youth, chalked up to inexperience. But hiding this last part of her life was pure immaturity, explained only by fear and naivete. The relief she felt from finally telling someone confirmed her decision. Her parents needed to know. It was time. Exhausted from law school and the frantic pace of her life, it was easy to imagine crawling under the covers and sleeping until morning. But she came to Summit Lake to get her work done, to get back on track. Sleeping was not an option. She took 10 minutes to blow dry her hair and climb into comfortable sweats and thick wool socks. At the kitchen island, she turned on her iPod, pulled out her textbook, notes, and laptop, and got to work. Earlier, the shower and hairdryer had washed out the noise of the door handle rattling from outside, and the two strong shoulder thrusts testing the strength of the deadbolt. But now, after an hour of constitutional law, Becca heard it. A rattle or vibration at the door. She turned down the iPod and listened. A half a minute of silence passed. Then a loud rap at the door. 3 loud knuckle-to-wood claps that startled her. She checked her watch and froze with anticipation, knowing he wasn't supposed to arrive until tomorrow. Unless he was surprising her, which he was known to do. Becca ran to the mudroom door and pulled the curtains to the side. What she saw confused her. And in that confusion, her thoughts ran sideways. Excitement filled her gut, and emotion stirred her heart. And with so much clouding her mind, no single thought shouted loud enough to give her pause. Tears welled in her eyes, and a smile came to her face. She punched the code on the alarm system, bringing the red light to green, then released the deadbolt and twisted the handle. She was surprised when he forced the door open and, like built-up water against a bulkhead, pushed and slid into the mudroom. More surprising still was his aggression. Unprepared for the onslaught he threw at her, she felt her heels skid and drag across the tile floor until he slammed her against the wall. Clutching her shoulders, then a fistful of hair at the base of her skull, he wrestled her through the mudroom and into the kitchen. Panic wiped her mind blank. All the ideas and images there just seconds before, erased now, allowing her primitive instincts to take over. Becca Eckersley fought for her life. The violent flurry continued through the kitchen, Becca grasping and kicking at anything that might help her. She saw her textbook and laptop scattered to the floor as her wool-stockinged feet struggled for traction on the cold tile. As he jerked her through the room, Becca's legs frantically scissored back and forth. A wild kick met the kitchen hutch, sending dishes shattering across the floor. With the chaos in the kitchen still settling, bowls rolling, stools bouncing, she felt the carpet of the family room under her feet. It gave her leverage, and Becca used every bit of it to pull away from his grip. But her resistance only fueled her attacker's rage. He wrenched her head backward, ripping a clump of hair from her scalp and sending her into a free fall. When she landed, Becca felt her head crack against the wood frame of the couch as he heaved himself on top of her. The pain in her head vibrated down her spine. Her vision blurred, and the noise of the world began to fade, until his ice-cold hands thrust into her sweatpants. This snapped her back to consciousness. As the weight of his body pinned her down, she punched and clawed until her knuckles broke and her nails became thick with skin and blood. When she felt her underwear rip away, she screamed a piercing, shrill cry. But it lasted only a few seconds, until his hands found her throat and crushed her voice into raspy gasps. He was vicious and possessed as he silenced her, his hands clamping with a powerful rage around her neck. She sucked for air, but it would not come, and soon her arms fell like deflated balloons to her sides. And though her body could no longer respond to the panicked calls from her mind, she still resisted by never breaking eye contact with him, until her vision faded like her voice. Broken and bleeding, she lay there, her chest barely rising with shallow breaths. She drifted in and out, waking each time he brutalized her in angry, violent waves. It went on for an eternity before he left her. Before he fled through the sliding glass door of the family room, leaving it wide open and allowing the cold night air to fill the room and creep over her naked body, Becca's eyelids fell to slivers. All that was left now was white halogen glowing in the doorframe, bright against the dark night. Becca lay motionless, unable to blink or look away had the desire come to her. It did not. She was strangely content in her paralysis. Tears slid down her cheeks and climbed the curve of her earlobes before dripping silently to the floor. The worst was over. The pain was gone. His fists no longer pummeled her, and her throat was finally free from his crushing grip. His hot breath gone from her face, he was no longer on top of her, and his absence was all the freedom she wanted. On the floor, with her legs splayed and arms like two broken tree limbs attached to her sides, she faced the wide-open patio door. The lighthouse in the distance, with its bright beacon calling out to lost boats in the night, was all she knew and all she needed. It was life, and she clung to its swaying image. Far away, a siren bounced through the night, low at first, then gathering strength. Help was coming, although she knew it was too late. Still, she welcomed the siren and the aid it would bring. It was not herself she was hoping to save. Chapter 2. Kelsey Castle, Events Magazine, March 1st, 2012. 2 weeks after Becca's death. Kelsey Castle's return to work was quiet and without ceremony, just the way she wanted it. She parked in the rear lot so no one would notice her car, and rather than risk the elevator, she snuck in the back door and climbed the stairs. Early still, most of the staff was battling rush hour or snoozing the alarm clock. She couldn't stay invisible forever. She would have to talk to someone. But Kelsey hoped to keep her office door closed and play catch-up for a few hours, uninterrupted by sad smiles and how-are-you stares. The cubicles were empty when she poked her head out of the stairway. In a smooth stroll, she walked the hallway, keeping her eyes set on her office door, a racehorse with blinders. The door to her editor's office was open with lights blazing. Kelsey knew she wouldn't beat him to the office, never did. After a few more steps, she reached her office, slithered through the door, and quickly shut it behind her.
"What are you doing here?"
Penn Courtney asked with a look of disapproval.
"You're not supposed to be back for 2 more weeks."
He was sitting on her couch, feet on the coffee table, Paging through drafts of articles that would run in this week's edition, Kelsey took a deep breath as she turned from her closed door. Why are you in my office? Whenever you need something, you wait in my office.
Good to see you too.
Kelsey walked to her desk and dropped her purse in the bottom drawer. Sorry. She took another deep breath and smiled. Good to see you too, Penn. And thanks for everything you've done for me. You're a good friend.
You're welcome.
He paused a moment before continuing.
How you doing?
Good God, right through the gates and I get it. We talked about this already. I don't want everyone running around here asking me how I am every minute of the day.
Hence the stealth return before the troops arrive. Let me guess, you took the stairs.
I need the exercise.
And parked in the back lot.
She just stared at him.
You can't hide from everyone. People are concerned about you.
I get that. I just don't want all the mushy stuff, you know? Penn waved his hand.
Won't ask again.
He organized the papers in front of him in neat stacks to keep his hands busy.
But really, what are you doing here?
I'm stir-crazy at home, so 6 weeks isn't going to work. I made it a month, that's all I can take. So back to my original question. Why are you in my office? Penn stood from the couch, a stack of papers in his hands, and walked to the front of her desk.
I was going to do this in 2 weeks, but I guess I can ask you now.
Kelsey sat behind her desk. The computer screen already captured her attention as she scrolled through emails. Look at all these emails. Hundreds, see? This is why I wanted to do some work from home.
Forget the emails, Penn said. They're all junk.
He let her read for a minute before he continued.
Have you ever heard of Summit Lake?
No, what is it?
A little town in the Blue Ridge Mountains. Quaint, cozy. Lots of out-of-towners who spend time at their weekend homes. Water sports when it's warm, ski trails and snowmobiling when it's cold.
Kelsey glanced at him, then back to her computer. You need any Propecia? There are about 50 emails here that hawk it. Penn ran a hand over his smooth scalp.
I think it's too late for that.
Viagra? Do these idiots know I'm a woman? Yeah, most of these are junk.
I want you to go there,
Penn said, dropping the pages on her desk. Kelsey stopped scrolling. Her eyes moved from her computer screen to the dropped pages and then up to her editor's eyes. Go where?
Summit Lake.
For what?
A story.
Don't start this, Penn. I just told you.
I'm not starting anything. There's a story there and I want you on it.
What story could possibly be in a tiny tourist town?
An important one.
Terrible answer, she said. You're getting rid of me because you don't think I'm ready to come back.
That's not true, he paused. I'm getting rid of you because I think you need it.
Damn it, Penn. Kelsey stood up also. Is this how it's going to be from now on? Tiptoeing around me like I'm a porcelain doll, giving me fluff pieces, and sending me on vacations because you don't think I can handle my job?
To be honest, no. I don't think you can handle your job right now. No, I don't think you should come back so soon. And no, this is not how it's going to be from now on.
Penn lowered his voice, put his palms on her desk, and leaned closer, looking straight into her eyes. Twice her age, with 2 sons and a successful vasectomy, Kelsey Castle was the closest thing he'd ever have to a daughter.
But this is how it's going to be right now. There's a story in Summit Lake. I want you to track it down. Is it an accident the town has a gorgeous view of the mountains and a beautiful blue lake? No. Would the magazine normally set you up in a 5-star hotel with all expenses paid? Hell no. But I own the damn magazine. You helped build the magazine, and I want this story done right. I'm sending you to Summit Lake for as long as it takes to figure it out.
Penn sat in a chair in front of Kelsey's desk and exhaled a long, calming breath. Kelsey closed her eyes and fell into her own chair. Figure what out? What's the story?
A dead girl.
She raised her eyebrows, stared at him with her big brown eyes. Go on.
It's the only recorded homicide in the history of Summit Lake, and currently a big deal up there. happened a couple of weeks ago, and it's starting to make national headlines. The girl's dad is a prominent attorney. Family's wealthy. Police have no leads yet. No suspects, no persons of interest. Just a girl who is alive one day and dead the next. Something's not adding up. I want you to rattle some cages and poke around. Find what everyone else is missing. Then give me an article that people want to read. I want to plaster this poor girl's face on the cover of Events, not just with a story about her death, but with the truth. And I want to do it before the other vultures pick up the scent and descend on Summit Lake. Once that small town fills with reporters and tabloids, no one's going to talk.
Kelsey pulled the pages Penn dropped on her desk and skimmed through them. Not as fluffy as I thought. Penn made an ugly face.
Do you think I'd send my best crime reporter to write about cute shops and galleries?
He stood up.
Take a couple days here to do your research, then off you go. Find out if there's a story up there. And if there is, write the hell out of it. And I don't expect you back anytime soon. I want this for the May edition. That means even if you get this story straight the day you arrive, you've got the hotel for a month.
Kelsey smiled. Thanks, Penn. Chapter 3. Becca Eckersley, George Washington University. November 30th, 2010. 14 months before her death. In the recesses of the George Washington University Library, Becca Eckersley sat with her three friends. Desk lamps illuminated their table, brightening textbooks and papers, and highlighting their faces in the otherwise darkened space. 3 years earlier, she arrived on campus with no high school friends, but Becca found no problems adjusting to college. Freshman year, she roomed with Gail Moss, and the two quickly became friends. Becca and Gail, together with their two guy friends, Jack and Brad, were all headed for law school. They studied together regularly and made an unusual foursome.
"People say it all the time," Gail said.
"What people?" Brad asked. "Who talks about us so much?"
"I don't know," Gail said. "Just other kids. I've heard girls talk."
"And what's their problem?"
"They just think we're weird."
"Who cares what they think?" Brad said. "Seriously, this is all in your head."
"It's not in my head," Gail said. "Okay, I'll just put it out there and ask the question, why are we friends?"
"What do you mean?" Becca asked.
"Because we like each other, we all get along, have things in common. That's why anyone becomes friends."
"She means the sex, or lack of it, between us," Brad said. "She's just too shy to phrase it that way."
He looked at Gail.
"You better figure out a way to express yourself more clearly if you want to be a litigator."
"Fine," Gail said, closing her eyes momentarily to avoid eye contact. "Does anyone think it's odd that we've been friends since freshman year and there's been no hookups, no sleeping around, no drama?"
"You had a boyfriend for the first year we knew you," Jack said. "What was his name?"
"Gene."
Jack laughed and pointed at Gail. "That's right. Huge. I love that guy. Sort of a tool, but in a geeky, cool kind of way."
Brad laughed also.
"I forgot about that guy. He hated when we called him huge. It's just Gene," he kept saying. "Remember that weekend?"
Becca laughed now, too. "The just Gene weekend? Oh my God, that seems like more than 3 years ago."
Gail tried not to smile. "Yeah, very amusing. He never came back to D.C. after that weekend. Anyone notice that?"
"He broke up with you a few weeks later, didn't he?" Jack asked.
"Yes, because of that weekend."
"Come on," Jack said. "Because we called him huge?"
"Forget it," Gail said. "My point is that our little foursome here is unique. Two girls, two guys, all best friends, in college, without any of the crazy stuff to mess it up."
Jack closed his business law textbook. He patted Brad on the back.
"Brad here will be the most powerful senator in Congress. You two will be schmuck lawyers working for him. I'll be a lobbyist getting him all his money, and we'll all still be best friends. Who cares why? And who cares if other people don't understand?"
He threw his books into his backpack.
"I've had enough for tonight. Let's get a beer at the 19th.
"Amen," Brad said.
They packed their things and stood to leave.
Becca stared at Jack.
No one's worried about Professor Morton's final? She asked.
I'm worried, Jack said. But I'm on the slow infusion process, which allows my brain to absorb his terribly boring and abstract lectures in small spoonfuls. If I cram it all in, most of it ends up seeping out.
Yeah, Becca said. That's a great plan for someone who's kept up with the readings all semester, but for the rest of us, we'll need to cram. You guys go without us. Gail and I are staying.
Come on, Jack said. Don't be lame.
Finals are in 2 weeks, Becca said.
Call it quits for tonight, and we'll put in extra time tomorrow, Jack said.
Brad stood up and lifted his hands.
Boys and girls, Bradley Jefferson Reynolds has you covered. This was supposed to be a surprise, but I can see you all need to know now. I will have for us, by next week, a copy of Professor Morton's Business Law Final Exam, to be used and abused as you all see fit.
Becca pursed her lips. Bullshit.
No bullshit, Brad said. I have a source, and that's all I can say for now. So let's all have a beer to celebrate.
Becca looked at Jack, who shrugged his shoulders.
Who are we to doubt this guy?
He said. She reluctantly packed her things and looked at Gail. This'll be like the time you promised everyone full-length essays for the Asian history exam freshman year, and we were up until 5 o'clock a.m. finishing things for him when he hit a wall. She flexed her fingers to make quotation marks while looking at Brad. Remember that?
This is different, Brad said.
Sure it is. Becca threw her bag over her shoulder and grabbed Brad by the inside of the bicep, resting her head on his shoulder as they walked out of the library. But I'll still love you when you don't come through, even though I'll have a C to tarnish my transcripts. Brad patted her head as they walked.
No Ivy League law school will accept you with a C on your transcript. Looks like I'll have to come through for you.
The 19th bar in Washington's Foggy Bottom neighborhood held the normal crowd for a Tuesday night, overflowing with college students in the peak of their existence. Most came from wealthy East Coast families and had plans for political careers or law. Some wanted other things, but they were outnumbered. They found an empty table near the front window, a floor-to-ceiling pane of glass that allowed passersby to look in with envy and see the lives of college kids on the way to stardom. They ordered draft beers and fell into their common routine of debating politics. After a few beers, Brad began his well-practiced, curse-riddled speech about there never having been a U.S. president who truly ran on his principles and then governed the same way.
They always fall prey to the politics of Washington, always give in to special interests. Can anyone name a president who really had the citizens in mind during the majority of his decisions in office? None of them did, and the current one doesn't either. It's all about power, keeping power, and dishing out power to those who throw the most money at them.
You tell him, Bradley, Becca said, and you're going to put an end to it all, right?
Or die trying. And I'll start with the crooked son of a bitch who calls himself my father.
He took a sip of beer.
As soon as I have the credentials.
I'd build some contacts and support before you go after your own father, or tort law in general.
Good idea, Brad said,
pointing at Becca and then sloshing another sip of beer like he was in an Irish pub about to arm wrestle. He ran his forearm across his mouth dramatically and stared off at the ceiling.
The others were laughing now at the show. It's got to come out of right field. Totally unsuspected. Yeah, I'll build a coalition. And when the old man thinks he's got things covered, I'll take him down like Giuliani tackling the Teflon Don. Not even accepted to an accredited law school yet, and this guy's comparing himself to Giuliani.
Jack laughed.
Love your confidence.
Becca and her friends loved Brad's tirades. Jack and Gail listened for entertainment value, but Becca had a keener ear. She knew Brad best. She knew his secrets and his desires and his struggles. She understood his opinions were born out of rebellion. An oppressive father, who amassed a fortune running one of the biggest tort law offices on the East Coast, had tried too hard to steer his son's life in a direction Brad did not want to go. In a mixture of feigned surrender and secret revenge, Brad agreed to an education at George Washington University and would soon endure an Ivy League law degree.
But instead of joining his father in thievery, as Brad put it, he would use the degree and education his father paid for to go after tort law and one day shut his father down. So the plan went, anyway. In the 3 years they knew each other, Becca had met Brad's father on a number of occasions. Becca's father knew him too. Their dads had a professional relationship, with Brad's father hosting an annual weekend at the Reynolds' hunting cabin, where a dozen rich lawyers shot elk, smoked cigars, and talked business. Becca's father was invited the year before and came home with stories about Mr. Reynolds being a true ball buster, a cold, hard man who pushed his children in unhealthy ways. Becca never had difficulty understanding Brad's resentment. As punishment for his father's absenteeism from Little League tournaments and soccer practices and Orioles games and anything in high school besides brief appearances at debates to let his son know his deficiencies, Brad decided to use his father's will against him. It was an insidious plan that would take years to accomplish, and if it ever came to fruition, if Brad's resentment didn't fade with maturity, and if his interests didn't change with time, Becca figured there was no worse slap in the face to a parent than for their child to use the education they paid for to set out on a career that would hinder their own. So Becca did more than listen when Brad went on his rants. She knew there was a point beyond Brad's words. It was therapeutic for him to plot a years-long rebellion against his father. It was his way of releasing his frustration without doing it to his father's face, and without ruining a relationship that, in adulthood, might stand a chance at restoration. They ordered more beer when Brad calmed down. "Is everyone going home for Christmas this year?" Gail asked. "Because we're going to our place in Florida. My mom said you guys could come down." "My parents would kill me if I didn't go home," Becca said.
"Yeah," Jack said. "My mother would not go for that. Christmas is too big of a deal."
"Maybe," Brad said. "Really?" Gail asked. Brad shrugged.
"Yeah, maybe for a few days. My old man gets exhausting after about 48 hours. Christmas Eve and Christmas are about all I can handle with him. Maybe I'll head down for a few days after Christmas. Otherwise, I'll be back here and this place is dead until everyone gets back."
"We'll hang out on the beach and think of poor Jack freezing in Wisconsin."
"Rub it in," Jack said.
"It would be a lot of fun," Gail said. "You guys should think about it." Jack took a sip of beer and looked at Becca, then back at Gail.
"Maybe spring break, but I can't do it for Christmas."
Gail widened her eyes. "Spring break! My parents will be in Europe. We'd have the place to ourselves." "Unless you boys would rather head to South Beach for hookups with University of Miami girls," Becca said. Brad and Jack looked at each other and touched beers.
"Yeah, we'll let you know about spring break. We might have to make a quick stop down south," Jack said.
"Asses," Gail said. They laughed and ordered more beers. It was 2 weeks before finals. They were immortal. Chapter 4. Kelsey Castle, Summit Lake, March 5th, 2012. Day 1. High on a bluff in the mountains of Summit Lake, Kelsey Castle watched as the rising sun burned the horizon red and turned the wispy clouds into cherry cotton candy torn across the sky. Farther off the horizon, over the center of the lake, dark thunderclouds formed. A storm was coming, and it reminded Kelsey of her youth, of the sunny rainstorms that always came on her birthday, and of her grandfather's deep belly laugh when they saw the clouds roll in. The downpour happened quickly from newly developed clouds, and her grandfather would whisper in her ear as beads of water ran down their faces and wrinkled their clothes against their bodies. "Happy birthday to the Rainmaker." Everyone else ran for cover, newspapers or jackets overhead. Kelsey and her grandfather danced and kicked puddles as the rain came down. All the while, a bright blue sky, just beyond the storm clouds, threw slashes of sunlight across the ground and highlighted the raindrops like diamonds pouring from the sky. And just as quickly as the storm developed, it would pass, leaving dripping trees and street puddles that reflected the blue sky. It was an odd phenomenon Kelsey grew to love. that they happened each year on her birthday, was a special tag on her life that said someone, somewhere was watching over her on her special day. At least, that's what her grandfather always told her. She walked to the edge of the bluff now and took deep breaths to bring her breathing under control. Arriving in Summit Lake the night before, Kelsey jogged through town early this morning, quiet and still in the dawn hours. She took 20 minutes to survey the center of town, jogging past storefronts and galleries, and exploring side streets to get a feel for the place. After two laps around the town square, the waterfall was her next stop. It was, besides the lake itself, the most famous landmark this tiny town had to offer. And now, standing on the bluff where the falls originated, and looking out over the sunrise and the town, Kelsey wanted to call Penn Courtney and thank him for getting her out of the city and away from her house. Thank him for giving her some time away she didn't want to admit she needed. There were books and experts that might help her, but Kelsey was not the type to confide in those structured aids. She always relied on an inner strength to get her through difficult spots in life, and this rough patch would be no different. The waterfall fell for 100 feet, passing just in front of the mountain face to eventually crash into the lagoon below. Spruce trees flanked the falls and bearded the mountainside, merging with a dense forest that isolated the lagoon. On the far side of the trees, the town of Summit Lake took shape. From Kelsey's vantage point high on the bluff, the town belonged on a postcard. One main drag, Maple Street, ran through the center of town with 5 roads slicing across, each heaped with shops and boutiques and restaurants and galleries Kelsey had inspected earlier during her run. On the north end was the Winchester Hotel, an old Victorian building that had been hosting guests of Summit Lake for decades and where Penn Courtney arranged for her to stay. 5 blocks from the Winchester, on the south end of Maple Street, St. Patrick's Church was a majestic structure, built from white stone and decorated with Gothic wooden entry doors and a tall steeple that looked like a needle ready to puncture the sky. To the east was a vast expanse of the lake, after which the town was named, and together with the western mountains where Kelsey stood, it sandwiched the town of Summit Lake into a cozy setting known for summer houses and weekend getaways. Homes trickled down from the foothills and circled the lake. A few tiptoed on stilts into the water. The stilt houses, with tiled roofs and large bay windows, were arranged in 2 long arching rows to give each a beautiful view of the lake. This morning, the cresting sun threw starbursts off the windows. Kelsey stared over it all. Somewhere, in this quaint tourist town, a girl had been murdered. It seemed too nice a place for such a thing to happen. As she stared down from the bluff, Kelsey felt connected to the town. It had a story to tell her. And even though Penn Courtney sent her here to slowly get her swagger back, to ease her gently back into the occupation she once ruled, Kelsey had no intention of taking it easy. She had interviews to conduct, facts to gather, and evidence to discover. Still, Penn knew what he was doing. Kelsey spent the weekend in Miami researching the Eckersley case and picking through the scarce details about how the girl had died. Now in Summit Lake, she was scouting the town, scoping angles, plotting her path to discovery, immersing herself in a different world and an unfamiliar setting. She was on the beat again, and it was the first time in 5 weeks she felt alive. Kelsey knew, however, the distraction wouldn't last forever. She came to Summit Lake to write the story of a girl's murder, but she also came to put her own demons to rest. That would require self-reflection, something she was not good at. Sitting on the edge of a boulder, she took a deep breath. The creek gurgled as it flowed past, its steady current pulling the clear water around rocks and over submerged logs and to the edge of the cliff, where the water began its roar as it fell. As Kelsey watched the water spill over the edge, a single raindrop tapped her nose, then another, and another. After a minute, a solid drizzle fell across the bluff, slowly increasing to a heavy rain that pelted the creek and rippled its surface. She smiled as the rain drenched her, soaked her clothes, and matted her hair. She looked out at Summit Lake. The stilt houses were still bright with the dawning sunlight. A sunny rainstorm, and it wasn't even her birthday. Chapter 5. Becca Eckersley, George Washington University, December 2nd, 2010. 14 months before her death. Brad's arm supported her head as Becca lay in his bed. It was past 3 in the morning, and not unusual for the pair to fill the empty hours of night with conversation. They talked about their dreams of being lawyers, of litigating cases in front of the Supreme Court, and changing the way Washington worked. They talked about the law schools they would pick if such a thing were possible, to pick a school rather than the other way around. They talked about love and what they each looked for in the perfect mate. These all-night discussions, which bordered on intimate but never crossed into that territory, were not purposely kept a secret from Gail and Jack. It just happened that way. Without discussing why, they never shared their nights. They existed only between Becca and Brad. "Okay," Brad said. "Give me one thing that's an absolute deal-breaker for dating someone." Becca took no time to answer. "Back hair." "Back hair?" Brad said. "Come on, how's a guy supposed to avoid back hair?" "Wax it or shave it, but don't display it. Complete turnoff." "What if you dated a guy for 2 months, really liked him, and then learned he had a back like a sweater?" "Over," Becca said. "Just like that?" "Well, that's your scenario. I don't accept the premise of the situation since I'd never get as far as really liking a guy who had that much back hair."
"But how would you know? It's the middle of winter, and you've never seen him with his shirt off. Shouldn't you work through it before you dump the poor guy? It's a minor problem."
"Eating with your mouth open is a minor problem. Back hair is something worse."
"Okay," Brad said, rolling onto his side and supporting his head with his bent elbows so they were face to face. "What does my back look like?"
"What is this, a test?"
"Just want to see how aware you are of something that bothers you so much."
"Okay," Becca said. "A few non-threatening follicles on your shoulder blades and a benign tuft at the small of your back. All in all, a perfectly acceptable back."
"You've got some kind of nasty fetish, huh? That was pretty accurate."
"We've spent about 100 nights lying next to each other, talking until sunrise. I think I know what your back looks like. Plus, I watched you and Jack play volleyball at the beginning of the school year. Both of your backs are acceptable." Becca rolled over and sunk her hands under her head. She wore a pink t-shirt that was tight around her chest, and when she raised her arms, it crept up her stomach to reveal dual pelvic bones that sat just above the band of her sweats. Brad always thought she was beautiful, with her blonde hair and olive skin and perfect teeth. She was a stunner in every room she entered, and Becca drew the eye of most guys she encountered. But the moments Brad loved most were these, when she was all his, no one else around to steal her attention. She was most exquisite in this intimate setting, lying in his bed, relaxed and content, and not trying to be gorgeous. He knew these short clips of time would last only until the morning light, which was why he savored them so much. There would come a time when he would tell her how he felt, but he wanted things to happen naturally, without forcing them. He knew it was the best way for a long relationship to start. And somehow, for a testosterone-riddled 21-year-old, lying next to Becca all night never produced an anxiousness for sex. He was always content simply talking and exploring her mind, and when she fell asleep, listening to her breathe. There was, of course, the time freshman year when they came home from a late-night party, buzzed from vodka punch, and ended up kissing in his dorm room before they both passed out. They never talked about that night, never discussed whether feelings had developed. Instead, it was hidden away, under the easy cover of drunkenness, and both pretended not to remember the incident. Now, 3 years later, they had never been intimate since, although this did nothing but cause Brad to fall more in love with her. He waited nearly 4 years for something to happen between them, and he knew it would. Maybe after graduation, when they were out of the environment of college and away from Jack and Gail, maybe then it would be less awkward. And that was fine. He could wait. He heard Becca's breathing take on a slow, deep rhythm as she fell asleep. He put his head on the pillow, resting his forehead against her temple, and laying his arm over the twin peaks of her pelvic bone. Brad closed his eyes. On these nights, the sun always came too soon. She never stayed long in the mornings, and the bed was always empty when he woke. An avid runner and study junkie, Brad knew Becca was either snaking through campus with headphones dangling from her ears, or already at the library with her hair in a ponytail, glasses in lieu of contact lenses, and a tall cup of coffee sitting next to whatever she was studying. Business law, probably. Final exams were in 2 weeks, and Brad knew she was struggling. He found her note on the pillow, where she always left them. They were not much. A sticky note, or a torn piece of loose-leaf paper, sometimes a napkin. They held her words, though, and it was something he loved. Notes like these were meant to be read and tossed, discarded without thought. But Brad could never bring himself to throw them away. He read this one. B, had fun last night. Thanks for sharing your pillow. No worries. Your back looks good to me. B. Brad folded the sticky note and dropped it in the shoebox under his bed that held all the other BB notes she'd left him over the years. Then he hit the shower and worked all day on his plan. Becca told him she was in bad shape for finals, and it was all the motivation he needed. He had to come through for her. It would take most of the day and some conniving, but when he showed up at the library that night, he carried a look of satisfaction on his face. It was late. Gail and Becca had already gone home. Only Jack remained, sitting at a desk and poring over an open textbook, notes strewn around him. "I got it," Brad said, as he walked into the dimly lit alcove that marked their study spot. A single recessed bulb contrasted stiffly with the dark surroundings of the library and illuminated Jack's cubicle desk. They studied here often, a second-floor area where old periodicals were stored on brown metal shelves and covered in age. 4 desks had been abandoned, but during their freshman year, they spaced them out head-to-head, cleaned them off, and screwed in new light bulbs. When serious study was necessary, they used the desks, which offered privacy. When group study was easier, they sat at the large table with built-in green awning lamps. There was no traffic in this abandoned part of the library, and they never had to worry about how loud they were. They cracked open cold cans of Newcastle beer after particularly good study sessions or at the end of finals week when they knew they wouldn't be back in the library for weeks. Brad managed to disarm the alarm on an infrequently used emergency door, and it became their escape route when the library closed and they stayed for an extra hour of cramming. "Got what?" Jack asked, leaning back in his chair and stretching away the stiffness in his shoulders. Brad smiled and dangled a key between his thumb and index finger. "Access to Milford Morton's office and the business law final." "Whatever," Jack said in a dismissive tone. "Not whatever. I got the key to Morton's office." "How?" Brad walked closer. "Mike Swagger. Said he got it from someone last year, but old Professor Morton was out on sabbatical, so he never used it. I had to beg him for it. Told me if it ever got back to anyone important that he gave me this key, he'd chop my nuts off. And that's a direct quote." Jack took the key and studied it. Throughout the year, it was a mythical thing, a dredged-up story that went around the fraternity and around campus, and especially around the 100 or so kids of Professor Milford Morton's business law course, that somewhere, someone had a key to the professor's office. And in years past, stealth operations had been conducted during finals week to perpetrate a heist of the final exam. The stories were large and embellished and mostly bullshit, Jack thought. Until now, until he held what was supposed to be the key to the professor's office. Jack studied it for a while longer. "No," he finally said. "It's all part of the myth."
"What do you mean?"
"Brad, you're not going to be this naive when your opposite tries to paint you into a corner in the courtroom, are you? Think about it. The key shows up the year after Morton's sabbatical, so no one's around to confirm if it really works. The two of us take all the steps to use it, including breaking into the building. And then we look like idiots when we're standing in front of Promo's office in the middle of the night, jabbing at a lock with a key that doesn't work. Swagger said he got it from a senior last year who broke into Morton's office the year before and had a copy of the exam. The exact test, word for word."
"Right," all once removed and 3 years ago. It's like the guy who has a cousin who knows a guy who had his kidney stolen. What the hell are you talking about? He meets a girl and goes back to her hotel. Next thing he knows, he wakes up in a bathtub filled with ice and a note that tells him to call 911 immediately because his kidney has been stolen for the black market. Shut up, Jack. This key is the real deal. So's the story about the guy's cousin's friend. Woke up, no kidney. Brad grabbed the key from Jack's hand. Trust me, it's legit. Says Mike Swagger. Isn't he in his 7th year of college? Are you scared, Jackie boy? Do you even need a copy of the test? Jack asked. I thought you were acing this course. I'm doing fine, but promo is notoriously boring and vague, so who couldn't use a little help? There was a gap of silence. I know Becca could use some. She's struggling big time. Struggling for our dear little friend means she might not eke out an A, and the perfect student will have a B for the first time in her life. She's saying a C if things go badly. Maybe worse. Becca's always on her way to a C, until her scores come in, and she keeps the 4.0 GPA she's had since first grade. It's Becca's little thing she does. It gets her attention, and then everyone congratulates her for rising to the challenge and pulling out an A. Don't fall for it. You're not getting out of this, Jack. Out of what? We're friggin' breaking and entering. Jack smiled. We'll get the boot if we get caught. Brad raised his eyebrows. Let's not get caught.
Chapter 6. Kelsey Castle, Summit Lake. March 6th, 2012. Day 2. On her second morning in Summit Lake, Kelsey woke under a down comforter in the Winchester Hotel, wrapped in thread-counted sheets higher than anything she would purchase on her own. Pulling herself from the warmth of the bed was not an easy task, but she came to Summit Lake to chase a story, and today, the race began. She also came to heal, and in the last many weeks, exercise had not been part of her routine. Typically a morning jogger, the four-mile path along the beach in Miami was a common route she took a few times each week. The doctors restricted her activity during her first 2 weeks of recovery. Lack of motivation and fear had prevented her after that. But today, she woke with an eagerness to move and sweat and burn her lungs. It was a cool morning in Summit Lake as Kelsey took off along the canopied path that wound through the forest and led to the waterfall. There was a moment of hesitation just before entering the forest, leaving the open area of the town center, where other people walked and shopped and gave off a general vibe of presence. To enter the dark, empty forest put a flutter in her heart. Being alone in her house for the past month was one thing. There, she could lock her door and close her windows. It was where she felt most comfortable. But running alone in the forest brought back the fear she was trying to rid herself of. The fear she was growing to hate. Nope, won't let you do it to yourself, Castle. With a deep breath, she took off into the forest in a slow jog. She wore shorts and a long-sleeved running shirt, her auburn hair held back in a headband. After a quarter of a mile, she'd worked up a decent burn, and her long, muscular legs glistened with perspiration. She found it was a popular trail, offering waves and good mornings to other joggers. The more people she passed, the more she calmed down. After half a mile, she stopped peering into the dark brush on each side of her. She was safe. It was dark along the running path, with only glimpses of sunlight poking through the foliage, but a cloudless spring morning welcomed her when she emerged at the falls a mile later. Several other joggers gathered around the lagoon and stared up at the falling water and the morning sunlight that caught the mist. Others sat on rocks and hung bare feet into the blue water. Kelsey took a quick count and settled on 30 people milling around the waterfall. Yesterday, the place was empty. With her hands on her head, Kelsey made her way over to the water. Her lungs ached, something a mile run would not normally do to her. When she reached the lagoon, she took deep breaths and stared at the water, like everyone else. "What's the attraction this morning?" Kelsey asked a woman who stood with her head cocked upward. The girl smiled. "The morning falls." "Yeah? Everyone comes just to look at the waterfall?"
Yes. Well, no, not just the waterfall. On clear mornings with no clouds, when the sun gets to a certain point over the horizon, it hits the water just right and ricochets off the granite behind the falls. For a few minutes, it's really pretty. The girl pointed. There. Kelsey watched as the sun penetrated the falls and highlighted the rock face behind the water. The streaming water became backlit, and for 2 minutes, the mountain bled orange glowing liquid from its side. It was a magical sight Kelsey had never seen in the flatlands of Florida. Ta-da, the girl said. The morning falls. A few seconds later, the sun hit the water at a different angle, and the orange glow faded. That's it, the girl shrugged. Pretty amazing. The girl paused when she looked away from the waterfall and made eye contact with Kelsey. Her sentences were slow and calculated. The sky has to be just right. No clouds, or not many, and the sun has to be at just the right angle. Some of us are fanatical about it. That's why it's so crowded on clear mornings like this. I assume it's your first time here? Yes, first time. Sorry to put you on the spot, the girl said. Aren't you Kelsey Castle? Kelsey smiled. Yeah. I read your stuff. I read events. And I read your novel. It's actually a true crime book. Nonfiction. The girl laughed, a little nervous. That's what I meant. It was crazy good. I recognize you from your author photo. Can't miss those pretty brown eyes. Thanks, Kelsey said. Welcome to Summit Lake. I'm Ray. Nice to meet you, Ray. Ray tapped her chin with her index finger, building up the confidence to ask her next question. Finally, she tapped one more time and then pointed at Kelsey. Are you here to look into the Eckersley murder? Kelsey cocked her head. I'm here to ask a few questions about it, yes. This thing's getting pretty big. Are you writing a piece about Becca in events? Depends what I find. And? And what? Figured anything out yet? Kelsey smiled. Haven't interviewed anyone yet, or written one word. I just got here a couple nights ago. The town is in quite a tizzy over this, you know? I've heard. Mostly because the police won't say anything about the case. It's always no comment on this and no comment on that. No one knows what's going on, and people are really frustrated. Scared, too. We just want some answers. And the way the police are being so quiet about the details is weird. But that's a small town, I guess. Lots of weird stuff goes on. Kelsey shrugged. I'm from Miami, so I don't know small towns. But one thing I'm sure of, someone always knows something. So either that person hasn't been found yet or hasn't decided to talk. The crowd began to thin. Many took the trail back through the woods. Others followed paths on each side of the lagoon and disappeared around switchbacks. I hope you have some luck while you're here, Ray said. Just remember, Summit Lake is not the same as Miami. People do things differently up here, especially the locals. They're very protective. So be careful in your approach. Kelsey raised her eyebrows. Good advice. I work at the coffee shop in town. Come by sometime and we'll have a latte. Kelsey smiled. I will. You a runner? I'm getting back into it. Yeah, me too. But not usually in the mornings. I'm always at the coffee house. Are you heading back to town? Yeah. Mind if I join you? Of course not. They jogged into the cover of the forest. Kelsey ran next to the girl without talking, working hard to keep pace and happy for the company. Her lungs ached and her legs burned. A good ache and a good burn. She was on her way back. Emerging from a crumbling building in life many others get trapped in, but one from which Kelsey Castle was determined to escape. Showered and dressed an hour later, Kelsey found the Summit Lake Police Department. Located next to the firehouse on Minnehaha Avenue, one block west of the town center, the red brick building was aged and tired. Gaps of missing grout sat between many bricks, and the concrete steps were chipped on the edges. Rust residue spilled from exposed rebar throughout the facade and stained the brick like bleeding wounds. An optimistic person would describe the building as having character. Others would say it needed a massive renovation. It wouldn't fit on Maple Street, next to the impeccably manicured shops and galleries, but tucked away on a side street, it was inconspicuous and invisible.
Kelsey walked up 3 steps and pulled open the door. Inside, a pleasant man with a security badge asked how he could help her.
"I'm here to speak with Commander Ferguson," she said. "My name's Kelsey Castle. I'm from Events Magazine, running a piece on the Becca Eckersley case." The man smiled.
"A few other reporters have been asking around."
"Not a good sign."
"The case is drawing some attention, I know," Kelsey said.
"Wait just a minute. I'll see if the commander's in."
Kelsey strolled around the reception area of the small headquarters building and read headlines from framed articles that hung on the wall. This was truly a small town, Kelsey thought. The headlines were of store openings, an elderly couple's 50th wedding anniversary, and of the Winter Days Festival. A murder was something not only foreign to this quaint town, but unwanted. She wondered how well equipped the police force was to handle it.
"Kelsey Castle, is that correct?"
She turned to see Stan Ferguson, a man she knew from her research and with whom she'd spoken last week as she planned her trip. He was well into his 60s, and the unlit cigarette that hung from his lips was surely the source of the wrinkles that roadmapped his face. The same habit contributed to his coarse voice, which was reminiscent of a man recovering from laryngitis.
"Yes," Kelsey said. They shook hands, and Commander Ferguson pointed to the front door, pinching the unlit cigarette between his fingers.
"You mind if we talk outside?"
"Sure."
They stood on the sidewalk in front of the old building. The commander lit his cigarette like he'd done a million times before. When he spoke, diluted smoke dripped from his nostrils.
"What can I do for you, Miss Castle?"
"I'm here to write a piece about Becca Eckersley, and I was wondering if there was anything you could tell me about the case."
The commander smiled.
"I could tell you a lot. Depends on what you want to know."
"This is your police force, right? You're in charge here?"
"Never had another job. Been here 40 plus years."
Kelsey pulled a notepad from her purse. "Can you tell me a little about the night Becca was killed?" The commander took a pull from the cigarette and looked down the street toward the lake.
"Becca Eckersley was killed on a Friday night, February 17th. What's that, 2 weeks ago? Just over? She was alone in the family's Stilt house the night she died. You familiar with Stilt Row?"
He pointed toward the lake. Kelsey nodded. She remembered the row of stilt houses she saw during her trip to the top of the falls.
"Came up here from George Washington University, where she was a first-year law student, to study for an exam. Get away from all the distractions, I suppose. She spoke to her parents earlier in the day. A call placed from her cell phone in the morning hours when she was on the way down. And a second call placed from the Eckersley's home phone just after 7 in the evening. It was around 10 p.m. when the next-door neighbor noticed the Eckersley's patio door wide open. With temperatures in the 20s, he knew something wasn't right. He poked around and found Becca unconscious on the living room floor."
Another puff from the cigarette.
"She died at Summit Lake Hospital the next morning."
"Did you see the house that night?" Kelsey asked. The commander nodded. "Can you describe the scene?"
"Evidence of a struggle. A hell of a one, too. Overturned furniture, stools and such. Becca's study materials strewn across the floor. Dishes were broken. All in the kitchen. So we know most of the struggle happened there. But no evidence of forced entry. No broken windows, no jimmied locks. Doors were all in good working order, and all the windows were locked."
"So she opened the door for him?" Kelsey asked.
"Or he had a key. Or he was already in the house when she got there. A few different possibilities."
"What's your take?" The commander shrugged.
"Doubt he had a key. The family could account for all of them, both parents and both kids. No duplicates. None were hidden, and no neighbors had any. I also doubt he was in the house before Becca got home. There was a security system that was always set when the Eckersleys were out of town. We checked with a security company, and they pulled a log of each time the security code was entered. On the day Becca was killed, the code was registered at 3 in the afternoon, presumably when Becca got into town. She disengaged it when she entered the house. Then a half hour later, When she left the house, it was re-engaged. A third and fourth time right about 7 o'clock when she got home. Then reset it immediately, knowing she wasn't going out again. This coincided with a phone call she made to her parents at about that time. Then once again the code was entered, about 8 o'clock. When she opened the door for her killer, Kelsey said, "That's the thought." So it was someone she knew. That's one theory, yes. Mine, maybe. But not the most popular. No? What's the most popular theory? The Vic's purse was missing, so some around here are running with a burglary gone bad presumption. But no leads. Not yet. Do you have any suspects? Had a bunch at first. Always do. But click by click, we checked them all off the list. Family members? All cleared. Solid alibis and no motive. Good family, close, wealthy and clean cut. Parents aren't even on my radar. And Becca only had one brother, who was in New York the night she was killed. Boyfriends? Working on it. Kelsey paused. I'm trying to get a hold of the autopsy, she said. And maybe the notes from the EMTs were first on the scene. Can I access any of that from you or your department? The commander finished his cigarette. What are you after here, Miss Castle? The truth. The commander let out a horsey laugh. And you're going to find it before I do. Before or after, sir. I'm just here to write an article for my magazine, not get in your way. But I want to write an accurate article. I want to write about what actually happened, not what some people think might have happened. I feel for this girl who senselessly died, and for her family, and for this town and this police department. So when I write about all that, I want to make sure I've got things straight. The commander closed his eyes for a second. Sorry to come at you. We've never had so much press around, asking questions and second-guessing everything we do. Let's make a deal, Kelsey said. Besides maybe a newspaper or two that's got wide circulation, Events will be the biggest medium to cover this story. If you help me out, and I mean only me, give me exclusive access to what you know, I'll make sure anything that gets printed has your approval first. And what if I don't like what you write? It goes in the shredder and I start over, Kelsey said. Knowing Penn Courtney would disapprove of such a promise, this shredder policy was usually reserved for him. The commander raised his chin slightly as he considered this. There's been some unflattering things written about us so far. Like we don't know what we're doing, and we're screwing this case up from here to hell.
You've got 40-plus years of experience to draw from, yes?
Sure. Not 40 years of homicide cases, but I've been trained in such things and have been on the periphery of other homicides in neighboring counties.
Kelsey shrugged. The way I see it, this is your town and nobody knows it better. If anyone's going to figure this out, it's you and your force. So help me out. And along the way, if I come across anything useful, you'll be the first to hear about it.
Hold on, the commander said, disappearing up the steps and into the building.
He came back 15 minutes later with a heavy folder 2 inches thick. He did the stare down to the lake again, then handed her the folder.
This is everything I have so far.
On the Eckersley case? He nodded. You're giving this to me, Kelsey said, taking the folder.
I know who you are, Miss Castle. I've read your stuff, and I know you're fair. There are some hacks up here, and they're gonna print anything that sells. The more sensational, the better. But the truth?
He shook his head.
That's on the back burner for them. I hold you and all your accolades to a different standard.
Kelsey quickly slipped the folder into her bag. Thanks for your trust.
On top of all that, a fresh set of eyes never hurts, and I didn't give you any of that information, if anyone asks.
You run this place, so who's going to ask?
I used to run it. The state guys are here now.
Who?
The state detectives, assigned from the district attorney's office. They've essentially put the cuffs on me and my department. Not only us here in Summit Lake, but the county sheriff too. They've taken this case from us, end of story. I was involved for the first few days. Then they took over, under the pretense that they're better suited at handling a homicide than my little department here. How does that happen? Politics. Becca was killed in my town. But because we're so small, her father put pressure on the governor, whom he's close with, and the governor put pressure on the DA. And the next thing you know, we've got state police poking around up here, making sure we know what we're doing. Then state detectives showed up and reminded me that no one around here has ever handled a homicide before. I don't argue that point, but if I had a little room and free flow of information, I'd do just fine.
Isn't Becca's family from Greensboro? The commander nodded. How can her father, an attorney from Greensboro, control information the police receive here in Summit Lake? The commander held up his thumb and index finger.
Money and connections.
But why? Wouldn't her father want this solved more than anyone?
I'm sure he does, but he wants it solved his way, and he wants all the messy details controlled. Becca's father, word has it, is getting ready to leave his private law practice for a judgeship. And if it comes out that your family, your daughter in particular, was out of control, well, it looks bad for him. How can he take the bench and control the public if he can't control his own daughter?
Kelsey made some notes. This robbery gone wrong theory, that comes from the state guys? The commander nodded. But you're not on board with it.
Not even close.
Kelsey thought for a moment. You said you needed a free flow of information. Like what?
You asked me about the medical records, an autopsy. I haven't seen either yet.
There was a long pause as the commander fished a fresh cigarette from his pocket and stuck it between his lips. He cupped his hands around his face and flashed his lighter, bringing the cigarette to life.
So this town that's been mine for decades? I guess I don't run it as much as I thought.
He blew smoke out of the corner of his mouth.
But not a minute goes by that I don't think of that girl who died in my town.
Kelsey nodded her head as she stared at Stan Ferguson, a troubled man plagued by a murder he'd never had the chance to solve. Anything else you can tell me before I dive into all this? Kelsey asked. He did the stare again, toward the lake and then back, ran his tongue around the inside of his cheek, flicked an ash from his cigarette.
She was hiding something, he finally said.
Who?
Becca.
Hiding what?
I don't know, and trust me, I've spent many hours working on it.
Why do you say that? That she was hiding something?
When a politically connected father works this hard to control the flow of information, it usually means there's something being covered up. Something they don't want the public to know, and certainly not an investigative reporter from Miami.
A familiar wave of anticipation coursed through her, a feeling Kelsey always experienced when she knew there was something to a story. She took some quick notes.
Are you starting to see why I'm willing to help a reporter help me?
The commander asked. I am, but I'm not sure I'll be able to get any further than you, not with these roadblocks in my way.
Just stay in the shadows. Don't let the state guys know you're poking around. If you come across anything interesting, let me know about it.
For sure. But to figure this out, I'll have to know everything about this girl, who she dated, who she hung out with. I'll need her emails and Facebook postings. I'll need to talk to her family and friends and her professors.
You're going to have to do without all that stuff, Miss Castle. Her family is not going to talk to any reporters, and there's no way for you to get to her emails. Her Facebook account was scrubbed the day after she was killed, and the state detectives will be on you in a heartbeat if you start tracking down Becca's friends, which is exactly what they're doing right now.
Her email and Facebook accounts didn't simply disappear. Commander Ferguson cocked his head.
Worse. They were subpoenaed by the district attorney's office, and from my current position, With Stadies all over me in this case, that means they've more than disappeared. They never existed.
So, where do I start?
Right here. Summit Lake is a small town, Miss Castle. But it's a special town, too. People around here love this place, and they don't like what happened here. Summit Lake has a way of talking to you, through those people who love it so much.
He took a drag from his cigarette.
I know Becca spent some time at the coffee house the day she died. She was studying for a law school exam. She was there for a couple hours. Got eyewitnesses who placed her there, and the owner knows her parents real well, and said she talked to Becca briefly that day. I've talked to everyone in this town, and no one saw Becca after she left that cafe.
Commander Ferguson pulled on the cigarette again until the red glow shrunk to the filter. He stubbed it out on the bottom of his shoe and stuck the filter in his pocket. He looked up and down the street, as if he were about to give up a secret.
If you want to heat up a cold case, he said, with smoke billowing from his nostrils, start by looking in the last place the victim was seen alive.